Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, your 22 minutes of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. We've got a great show for you this week. The upcoming Draconid meteor shower, a new release from Twin Cabins, and we'll speak with a NASA scientist about the search for life on exoplanets. Here's your scientist soundbite.
So we've gotten back into a time of year that is good for meteor showers. In November and December, each have one meteor shower per month, but October actually has two.
That's skywatching expert Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, Emily Howard and I are going to give you the science news of the week. Welcome, Emily.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
So what's going on?
A team of scientists from the universities of Sheffield and Sussex will build models of the systems in the brain that govern a honeybee's vision and sense of smell. Using this info, the researchers aim to create the first flying robot able to sense and act on its own.
Wow.
If successful, this project will meet one of the major challenges of modern science, building a robot brain that can perform tasks as well as the brain of an animal. For example, finding the source of a particular odor or gases in the same way that a bee can identify particular flowers. It's anticipated that the artificial brain could eventually be used in applications such as search and rescue missions, or even the mechanical pollination of crops. The project is called Green Brain, and you can learn more about it at earthsky.org.
On September 30th, a coronal mass ejection struck Earth's magnetic field, causing a geomagnetic storm. According to the website spaceweather.com, the impact was weak at first, but by the early morning hours of October 1st, according to U.S. clocks, moderately strong geomagnetic storms were underway. They are now subsiding. But there have been some great pictures coming in on our Facebook page of auroras caused by the storm in Earth's magnetic field.
There's also been a bunch of really cool pictures of last week's harvest moon coming in, so be sure and check those out. In other Earth news, Typhoon Jurlawat hit Okinawa, Japan on September 29th, then pushed on into Tokyo. Okinawa seems to have been the hardest hit area, with one reported casualty and 145 people left with minor injuries. As of this recording, tens of thousands of people are still without power.
In 2007, Saturn's large moon Titan was found to have lakes and seas on its surface. Last week, Spanish engineers announced their concept for a boat to sail Titan's seas. The Europeans are proposing a mission they call the Titan Lake In-Situ Sampling Propelled Explorer, or TALIS. The mission would include a boat probe. The probe would land in the middle of a lake in the north polar region of Titan. The boat would be propelled by wheels, paddles, or screws. After a successful landing, it would set sail for a nearby coastline, taking scientific measurements along the way. The mission is not much further than concept phase at this point, but we'll keep you up to date on any developments. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Michael Brennan.
And I'm Emily Howard.
Thanks, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
This week's Song of the Week is called Laika, from Los Angeles-based musician Twin Cabins, off his recently released album, I'm Sure. As a side note, in 1957, Laika was the first animal to orbit the Earth on the Sputnik 2. The Soviet space dog paved the way for future missions and human spaceflight. Song of the Week, Laika, from Twin Cabins.
Thank you.
Find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. I'm Jorge Salazar. Deborah Bird joins us now with news of the global night sky, October meteor showers, and a tale of a comet. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Jorge. So October is a great month for watching meteors. And the first one is peaking on the evening of October 7th.
Tell us more about it. What's happening?
So I hope you're hearing this before October 7th. Some of you won't. And for those of you who won't, we'll be talking about another meteor shower coming up later in October. But if you are hearing this before October 7th, the meteor shower actually has two names. It's called the Draconids, and it's also called the Jacobinids. So as you know, Jorge, meteor showers are named from the place in the sky from which they appear to radiate, after the constellation from which they appear to radiate. And the constellation that is associated with this shower is the constellation Draco, the dragon, which is in the northern sky. So this particular shower is really best for the northern hemisphere. Not so great for the southern hemisphere, but fantastic for the northern hemisphere, and fantastic the farther north you are on Earth's globe, because, say, if you're in the northern United States, even better than in the southern United States, because this constellation, the constellation Draco, is what they call circumpolar. In other words, it circles around and around the pole star and never sets below the horizon. So unlike some meteor showers where you have to wait for that radiant point to rise into the sky, which typically happens around midnight, this meteor shower, the Draconid meteor shower, is as good in the evening as it is between midnight and dawn. Yeah. So the evening of October 7th is the time to look.
Yeah, this sounds like a great meteor shower to take kids. They don't have to stay up late. You can just take them out in the evening sky, early evening maybe, and catch some meteors.
That's right. And the shower was fantastic last year. This shower is associated with a comet called Comet Jacobini-Zinner, which has a very interesting history. Is so interesting that sometimes the shower is referred to as the Jacobinids. And so nowadays, of course, you know, meteor showers associated with the constellation from which they appear to radiate. So officially, they're the Draconids. But you still sometimes hear this shower referred to as the Jacobinid shower.
Really? What's in a name? I mean, the name of the meteor shower refers to the place in the sky. And it kind of, if you're really careful, you can look and you can kind of trace lines and find the constellation. But the meteorites in the sky, they're actually pieces of this comet. Tell us more about what is a meteor shower, like what's happening here.
Well, meteors and annual showers do tend to come from comets. And so these are meteor showers that we encounter again and again as Earth orbits the sun. So what's going on is that comets are fragile, icy bodies, and they litter their orbits with this icy debris. And there are, you know, hundreds, thousands, probably millions of comets that are associated with our solar system. And so in the path of one of these comets, there's this trail of debris left behind. The comet may be nowhere near, but we're encountering the comet's orbit, and we're encountering that trail of debris, that icy debris that the comet left behind. Those little bits of debris enter our atmosphere, and that's what causes one of these annual meteor showers, like the Draconids or Jacobinids, that is going to happen on October 7th.
Yeah, and this comet was first officially discovered at the turn of the 20th century, is that right?
Yeah, the turn of the 20th century, and the comet was first discovered in 1900. It was determined to have a 6.5-year orbit around the sun. And this comet has had kind of a strange history in terms of people recovering it. When they see a comet and they predict its orbit and then they wait for it to come back, when it comes back, they say it's been recovered. But this comet was not recovered again until 1913. So it had a pass near our solar system where no one saw it. And then the first person who discovered it was, his name was Jacobini, so it was named for him. The second person who discovered it in 1913 was named Zinner, so now the comet bears both of those names, Jacobini-Zinner. But throughout the 20th century, at predicted returns of this comet, it sometimes returned and was found to return, and sometimes did not return. And instead, there was this very amazing display of meteors or shooting stars, as in fact there was in 2011.
Yeah, that was an amazing display, wasn't it?
It was. And in fact, it was mostly seen in Europe, and it was a very brief display. So what happens is that when a comet is nearby, and again, I said comets litter their orbits with debris, and that this debris just floats out there in the comet's orbit for, gosh, you know, who knows how long, millennia. And but when the comet is nearby, there's a particularly dense bunch of debris left behind. So whenever Jacobi Zinner is in the area, you're likely to see a really good display of these meteors. And that's what happened in 2011. So in 2011, people saw over 600 meteors per hour. So that's a lot of meteors. Usually a typical good meteor shower like the Perseid, you might see something more like 60 meteors an hour. So this is 10 times more than you might see in, you know, the typical best meteor shower of the year. But only a few people saw that shower because it had a very brief peak. So now we're back to this year, 2012. The comet is not nearby because it passed last year. And so the meteor shower probably won't be as good. But if you go outside, Jorge, on the evening of October 7th, you might see some meteors left behind by this very famous comet, Comet Jacobi Zinner.
Yeah, it has all the ingredients for a great meteor shower. The moon is cooperating with us, and it's an early evening shower.
That's right. The moon is out of the way. The moon is at last quarter that night, so it won't be rising until midnight. So on the evening of October 7th, get out there, take the kids, and see if you can see a meteor or shooting star or even more than one.
And Deborah, give us a hint of what's happening later this month.
Well, so if you miss the October 7th shower, if you're clouded out or you're listening to this after October 7th, there's an even more reliable shower, the good old Oriontid meteor shower that happens every year around the 21st or 22nd of October.
And we'll talk a little bit more about that next time. But thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird. And we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science.
We interview the world's top scientists, and we're heard millions of times each day. Thanks for listening. The habitable zone is a zone around a star that is favorable to life, where water may exist in a liquid state. Our planet Earth orbits in our habitable zone of our own star, not too hot, not too cold. Our orbit is relatively circular, but there are many exoplanets with more eccentric orbitals. New discoveries about organisms called extremophiles, which can exist in extreme conditions such as heat or cold, has led NASA scientists to consider updating our definition of a habitable zone to include those exoplanets with eccentric orbits of their home star. Earth Sky's Emily Howard spoke with NASA research astronomer Stephen Kane.
Welcome to Earth Sky.
Thank you.
Why do you think that astronomy's current idea of a habitable zone needs to be expanded to include planets with more eccentric orbits around their stars?
Right. Well, the reason is because there have been many huge surprises which have come out of our discovery of planets around other stars. We've found that other planetary systems are often very different from our own. One of the features of our own solar system is that the planets orbit the sun in almost circular orbits, so the distance between the planet and the star doesn't change very much. But we know that around other stars that there are many planets in what we call eccentric orbits. So it's like the orbit of a comet. So it can come in very close to the star and then move out into a long, cold winter. And when we calculate the habitable zone for all the different stars that host these planets, what we find is that a lot of these planets, even though they're in eccentric orbits, they can still spend a lot of their time in the habitable zone. So that then begs the question, well, can the planet sustain life while it's in that period, while it's in the habitable zone, and even keep that life while it moves out of the habitable zone? And so we've been doing a lot of study on things called extremophiles. And extremophiles are organisms which can survive in very, what we would consider, very extreme conditions. And that normally means extreme heat or extreme cold. So you could have something, a planet, which spends a lot of its time in the habitable zone, but then it moves out into a long, cold winter, and these extremophiles will go into a hibernation state. They'll reduce their metabolism, and then during that period, they're able to survive until the planet comes back into the habitable zone. What this means is that there's probably a far greater range of planets that may still be habitable that we haven't really thought too closely about yet.
So on these eccentric planets, would you expect that the majority of life there to be extremophiles? What sort of life would you expect to find?
I would expect fairly rudimentary kind of life because I just gave an example of a planet which is occasionally subjected to extreme cold temperatures. There's also the opposite, where you could have a planet which moves closer to the star and experiences intense amount of heat at the surface. But in those cases, the organisms can survive underneath an insulation layer of rock or ocean if there's water on the surface. But what that means is that the extreme conditions doesn't really enable, or I wouldn't expect it to enable, a great deal of complexity to the life in that it has to continually go into these conditions of low metabolism, of hibernation, in order to survive in those environments. The question is, of course, could they have evolved on those planets in the first place in order to be there to experience these conditions? Because the extremophiles that we study now on Earth, they have been around for a long time. And it's one of the unsolved questions in this is understanding fully what does it take to have life form there in the first place. And if it does, then can it sustain itself during these periods?
Very cool. If astronomers are to expand the definition of habitable zone, how many planets will this basically add as potential candidates for life?
Well, this depends on the types of planets that we're talking about, because a lot of the planets that we know of, which are in eccentric orbits, a lot of those are giant planets. And from our own experience of the solar system, we expect a lot of those giant planets to have moons. So it wouldn't so much be the planets per se which are habitable, it would be the moons of those planets which are habitable, and that could add untold numbers of possible habitable locations into the catalog of places that we should be looking for these kinds of life.
Earth Sky's Emily Howard speaking with NASA research astronomer Stephen Kane. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded in Earth Sky Studios in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Special thanks to our musical contributors. For more information about the music or the science you heard, visit earthsky.org. Until next week, be good to one another. I'm Michael Brennan. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much heart, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age.